Thank you. First, a commercial break. I'm happy to report this is going to be online by June 1st. I thought it was going to be July. I never heard of anything coming early. Okay, today will be a little less political than last week, but we can build on that because last Sunday, if you remember, we talked about the Sharia, the law, and the Tirutz, and the difference between Sunnis and Shia and what have you. I'd like to set the stage a little bit for about 5 or 10 minutes before getting into Sufism directly and to remind us of a few important principles. All religions have two basic components. They provide us with a cosmology and how this all came about. And they also provide us with a path to go back to our source. What's the meaning of the word religion? Do you all remember?
Return.
Huh? I heard it.
Return.
To return. It's from the Latin root of religare, and one of the meanings of that is to bind back to your source. So my definition of religion is to go home. Look, science does a wonderful job. We got down to the Big Bang and more, I guess. But nobody told us yet who lit the match. And so it's always an endless cause and effect question. And I love science. Believe me, I'm not putting anything down there. And so there's this big question. In Genesis, you have a particular view of how God created the world in 6 days and took a break. And in the Quran, they also have an explanation, and et cetera, et cetera. And so there's that part. And then there's the return to the source. And Sufism has its own unique way and view on how to go back to the source. And I'll get into that. Now, so that's one reminder about the meaning of religion. And the main two components of any religion that I've ever encountered is this idea they provide their own spiritual explanation of how this all came about and how to go home. And, of course, it's all based on faith. And, of course, the cognitive mind cannot know the absolute mystery some people call God. So in a way, we're ignorant. And like I keep reminding everybody I speak to, you got to understand that Alex Pappas's ignorance is better than yours. You know, and people go to war over that. I'm teasing you. Isn't that interesting? This is all a great mystery. And the main teaching in just about every faith is we cannot comprehend the absolute. We're really in darkness on faith, and we have to listen to our hearts. And because of that, I hope and pray that everybody will be very tolerant of one another. Okay. Now, there's also the religions of the world have a view of reality that's either dualistic, separation, or non-dualistic. For example, in the Abrahamic traditions, when we pray to God, if you do, or talk about God, where's God? Well, usually up, never sideways. But the main idea is the absolute is separate from us. So there's at least two. And if we're separate from the absolute and the divine, we find that in these traditions, they usually postulate that after the death of the body, there's an immortal soul. And that soul is different from God, separate from God, while housed in the body. And after death, this immortal soul, if you've been good, you'll be with the divine. If not, you know. But the idea is separation. There's more than two to the agreement here. Another view of reality is that whatever the reality is not two. Non-duality means not two. It doesn't mean oneness, because if you have a one, it implies a two. So, okay, Alex, well, what is this non-dual reality? Unfortunately, I can't tell you. I can only tell you what it's not. Because any attribute I give to this non-dual reality is, I have to express in a dualistic language. If I say God is love, love implies there's also hate. If you have hot water, you got cold water. So it's an apophatic negation approach to understanding that. Why am I talking about this? Well, those traditions, including a good percentage of the Sufis, say that we don't have an immortal soul that survives the body. We have an evolving consciousness, and if we purify ourselves, we will experience an emerging with the Absolute, and we don't have to come back anymore and go through being in a body, because every lifetime entails some suffering as well as good times. So the non-dual traditions, which are usually the mystical traditions, discuss the concept of liberation, that you have an evolving consciousness, and if you purify yourself and keep evolving your consciousness, there will be some kind of absorption or merging with this unknowable non-dual reality. Okay, I'll open that up a little bit more. So let's see, what else did I make here? All right. Would anybody like to ask a question about that before I go on to the next? Yes, I need a microphone here.
Why is it that these established religions think that it would be a bad thing to be reincarnated? I would say that it is the greatest blessing that could ever be bestowed upon a person.
Yeah, well, the question is that there's a premise which I don't it's not true of all religion, that reincarnation is bad. I don't think reincarnation is considered bad by any of the traditions, because you need to where are you going to develop and evolve your consciousness? We need to do it in this relative world that the Vedantins call Maya. This is very important. We have a body. We have an opportunity to develop ourselves. So that's really important. The point is, each lifetime is like a grade in school, and we keep learning and we keep evolving our consciousness, and that hopefully that we'll be able to return to our source. So blessed is reincarnation, but we do need to finish school sometime. Okay. The good news is the liberation traditions say it's our destiny, and that everybody will eventually graduate, some a little more rapidly than others. And if you really like to get a wonderful summary of this in all the traditions, you know, Aldous Huxley, everybody, he wrote a book called The Perennial Philosophy. And the first 95 pages of that book is a wonderful summary. And, you know, he's such a marvelous writer of these basic premises. He calls it the perennial philosophy. And there are four primary tenets. I haven't got time to go into all that today. We'll never get to Sufis. Okay. Now, what is Sufism? At the bottom of page one, I point out to you that Sufa is the word purity, and Suf means wool. The Muhammad, the founder of Islam, died in 632. It's a common era. He was 62 years old. Within 100 years after his death, actually starting like 30 years after that, there a mystical tradition was starting to develop in Islam. And I don't know if I have it here. In 747, a Persian mystic really is considered the first Sufi, bless you. the Sufi tradition is primarily rooted in Islam. I'll get into that a little bit more. And at this time, there were Christian monks wandering around in the Middle East, and many of them were practicing austerities. So, you know how you hear about self-flagellation? Well, some of them were wearing very coarse garments, in order to kind of put down the secular, the worldly things, and to focus on God. Well, that's one approach to purify yourself, I guess. And there's a famous saying that a Sufi is covered with thorns and it's covering purity underneath. But that's another thing. Okay. Now, Islam as a religion, just like Judaism and Christianity, is both the traditional mainstream Abrahamic traditions, including Islam, are dualistic in their worldview. The divine is separate from us, as I reviewed. But all of them have a mystical tradition that says the ultimate absolute is not separate from us. It is non-dual. Judaism has Kabbalah and the concept of Ein Sof or Ein. That's their name for the absolute. There are Christian mystics, Master Eckhart, St. Teresa, St. John of the Cross. They all spoke of the non-dual in their own way. And the Islamic tradition has the Sufis. So you have those two things going. So Islam has two components. I think on page 2 at the top, I give a wonderful one-line explanation of a complex subject. I hope it makes sense. Traditional Islam is dual, and mystical Sufism is both dual and non-dual. Now let me explain that. There are two... By the way, if you have a question as I'm speaking, please raise your hand and we'll get a mic to you. People on the spiritual path often experience the divine. You hear of saints having the experience of God or Jesus or the Virgin Mary. Abraham heard God talk to him, Moses and the burning bush. In all of those cases, the divine was separate from what is being experienced. So it's a dualistic thing. It's called revelation. The Abrahamic traditions are basically based on revelation of the divine to certain great prophets. Okay? So that's one form of mystical experience, is to experience the absolute, but you still have a sense of your ego and your I am consciousness. Is that clear to everybody? The other type of experience is ecstatic experience, where the experience is so overwhelming, there is no separation, there is no ego separate from what is being experienced in the divine. And in Sufism, there are two main categories of mystics. Those who, in order to achieve this union or emerging, some say that it comes through a transforming experience. It makes me think of St. Paul on the way to Damascus getting struck down. And it's an ecstatic experience, and you just have that incredible experience. There's another group of Sufis, and these are known as the drunken Sufis. They're drunk with the ecstasy of God. Okay? So you have one category, drunken Sufis. The other are the sober ones. Through daily practice, through study, they develop their consciousness, and they eventually hope to have the revelation and even further the union and bonding with the absolute. Am I being clear there? The revelation is dualistic, but still a very highly developed point in consciousness, and then merging in the absolute is a non-dual experience. In India and yoga, they call that Satchitananda, in Kabbalah is getting to the fifth level of soul called Yachita. But anyway, so anybody have any question at this point?
I wonder what the connection is to ritual in terms of reaching the ecstatic state.
I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
I wonder what the connection is to ritual in reaching the ecstatic state. I've seen Sufis dancing.
How does ritual help achieve the development of consciousness?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that there are different ways for different people on how to evolve your consciousness. Some people, I think one of the best way is there are different personalities, different paths for different people. Some like to do service in the world as their ritual. Okay? Some like to do devotion, where you have a formal setting. For example, you might have Holy Communion. Okay? And this type of thing. And in Sufism, they do chanting. Dhikr, they call it, saying the name of God. And then, of course, you can also have the ritual of dance and moving. Movement. You're all familiar with the whirling dervishes. This is another type of ritual. And so ritual is a spiritual practice. I think rituals primarily are helpful because they focus our mind on the spiritual when you're doing a ritual and not on the worldly things that keep our mind active. Okay. Any other question?
Yeah. I don't know if you... I think there is a dualistic mysticism. There is a dualistic mysticism because it's not it doesn't always have to be monistic, a mystical experience, and it's also.
Would you say that again? I didn't quite get it.
There are mystical experiences that are also dualistic, where there's also a loss of ego. Like you can lose your ego in the in God, even in the biblical God, you are through a surrender process, and then you you receive a transformation there too. Sometimes I think people think that most of the time mysticism is only monistic, and I'm here to say that it's not.
I think we're getting into definition.
I think it's more. I think it's reality too.
Oh yeah. I like to speak to it. If as long as there's a sense of ego, there is a separation. If during your and the traditional way, and you don't have to agree with this, but the traditional definition of a non-dual experience is when there's absorption and there the sense of I am is gone. Now. One of the best ways to answer you, I think, would be to turn to yoga, the last step of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. He speaks of the trance state two ways. The first is called Shiva Kapal Samadhi, where you go into revelation, then there is no sense of self, and you're gone. However, you do come back. You're in and you're out. It's called Savakapal Nirvana. The other trance state that Patanjali describes is called Nirvikapal Samadhi. Once you go into that, it's goodbye. So, but it's how you define terms. I have no quarrel with what you say, but this is how the traditions say it. Okay? All right, let us push on. Let's go to the sources of Sufism. Remember our friend Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher? Well, you have the Neoplatonists, where Plato, who was spiritual in his way, and he first talked about the soul and what have you, and there's that famous picture, you know, of Plato pointing upward when he's walking with Aristotle, his student, who's the materialist, the scientist, pointing to the earth. Well, later on, people started developing Plato's idea of the forms. By the way, I think the forms are another name for the non-dual reality, but that's my take. And one of the first and most important one was Plotinus. And he's one of my heroes. I think he's an incredible person. And he spoke of the one absolute, which, and if you read him a little bit, it's clear it's a non-dual position. He did not talk of a creative God, but he spoke of the emanation of the cosmos and had no understanding of that. And that he also postulated a path and how to return back. So Plotinus influenced Sufi thinkers as the tradition developed. Another important one is Gnosticism. Gnosis in Greek means to know. The highest knowing from the Sufi point of view is to know and experience your own divine nature. This is the most important thing. And so the practice, Sufi practice, emphasizes the idea of experiencing gnosis and the elimination of the sense of I am. And that develops this concept of fana, which I have there. And that's what's important there. Okay. One thing I like to share with you. Sufis at the top of page 3. Sufis value direct experience of the divine. The mind alone cannot lead to the divine presence. And here it is. The heart must be emptied of desires and egocentricity to make room for God's love. Seekers can only know God through the heart, not the mind. And here, of course, God doesn't mean a being. It's really talking about the mysterious absolute. If you define God as the mystery, then you don't have to have any faith. This is a mystery. It really exists. I haven't got time to go into it, but the Sufis and Islam in general say that our soul, which they call nafs, N-A-F-S, and it's singular. It drives me crazy. They put an S on it. Nafs. And there are different kinds of nafs and different aspects, which are really a description of the different types of things we must overcome in order to purify ourselves. The sense of I am, the sense I'm better than you, I come first, you know, all of that egocentric stuff. And there are a description of that. If you want a detailed explanation, you can go online, Wikipedia, you can spend $29 and buy the book, but Wikipedia has a really great explanation in detail of this. Now, oh, Joyce, and then.
Seekers can only know God through the heart and not the mind. I learned that the mind could be used to keep your attention.
Absolutely. The mind is a step, a very important first step to get to your heart. You have the mind and the heart. It's really important to honor what tools we do have. And that's what it comes down to. We're taught to use our minds. Don't deny who you are. You go through that process. And when we get to Al-Ghazali, it's very clear. One of the great Sufis we're going to talk about. He was a marvelous person. I'll get to him, but he gave up and dropped out for 10 years in order to get to the heart after he spent his whole life doing the mind. But the mind helped him, and he integrated the two together. It's a beautiful story. I hope I'll get to that in a few minutes. There's somebody else.
So you're defining, well, we'll just pick it, Sufism, by using something we might be familiar with, which is the Greek philosophy that's our tradition. Are there Islamic philosophies? And is this gentleman you just talked about? But we don't know them, so you're using something we might understand as the pedagogical.
I think I answer you on the top of page 2. If I don't, then let me know. At the top, the second, there's classical Sufism that's Quran-based and part of traditional Islam, which is what I've been talking about. And then there's neo-modern Sufism, which I have a section on toward the end of the talk, which is not Quran-based, but they respect Islam and Quran, but they're not tied into Islam formally. And those neo-modern sects are the ones that people know about the most here in the West, except perhaps Rumi and the Whirling Dervishes, which is Quran-based. Did I answer your question? Yeah, and I list the neo-modern ones that are not Quran-based. I don't know, page 7 or 8.
I guess in simple terms, Islam, and
Muhammad,
please use the mic. I don't have good hearing.
Okay. Islamic thinkers were bright boys and girls, too.
Say that again?
Islamic thinkers were as bright as Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle.
Yeah.
Or brighter.
Yeah.
Lest we forget that.
Who's right in religion is whom you have faith in. Yeah. No, I don't. I feel uncomfortable talking about somebody's right or wrong. It's whom you have faith in, because I'll say it again. The religions teach us, even though they forget it, that the cognitive mind cannot understand the absolute, only some kind of transcendental experience. That's the general position. Okay. Unfortunately, people go to war over this issue. It's very sad. Pantheism, Hindu mysticism, Quran also contributed to the development of... Let's talk about the Sufi orders a little bit. I think that might help in this discussion. And I'm talking about classical, traditional, Quran-based Sufism, which is by far the most important thing, even though the neo-movements get a lot of play here. But numerically, there are about 200 orders of Sufis in the world today, and millions of people. You must understand that Sufism was mainstream Islam from around 1100 to 1500 and still very important up until 1800. After 1800, after Wahhabi in Saudi Arabia, the Salafists took over, and eventually Sufism was considered heretical. And ironically, it was mainstream for hundreds of years. So this is not some unimportant little aspect of Islam. Okay, now the Sufi orders are headed by a person who's usually a master, who is a master and sometimes considered a saint, and they're addressed as either a sheikh or a peer, P-I-R, like Pir Valat Khan. Okay, and now you're going to join one of these 200 orders, and you might say, who's for real here? I mean, who's really an authority? This is a great thing in Islam. You know, I'm going to join up, but I'm going to make sure this guy is really legitimate. Well, they have what's called a silsila, or the chain, the golden chain in Islam, where the lineage of the master, he can trace his own genealogy back to the Prophet of Muhammad. Is that clear? And you can do that. Now, their differences, the Shia trace you back to Ali, then it jumps to Muhammad. The Sunnis trace you back to Ali and then include the three other caliphs that are in between Ali and Muhammad. I don't want to load you down. There's a chart in the book that shows this. But the main thing is those who can trace themselves back to the Prophet of Muhammad. My great-great-great-great-great-grandfather knew somebody who was one of the ten companions of Muhammad while he was alive. Oh, that's a very heavy duty. You get a big pattern of that. But it's very important, this idea of legitimacy. And so you may encounter that. Now, you have all these orders. Well, do they disagree and fight with each other? There are four things they find that they're very much in common at the bottom of page 3. And here, I'll speak to Joyce again here. One of the first ideas is you have to understand mind and experience gnosis, your own divine nature. Okay? Number two, to do that, you have to purify your heart. Love and devotion, they call it bhakti yoga in Hinduism, is a very important component of the path. And they favored the sober Sufi approach, most of them, rather than the ecstatic one, which is really dramatic, and I'll get into that, which is a more stable thing. Okay, let's push on here. The first saint I list here is a woman, Rabia. You might have heard of her. She was a great Sufi mystic and master. She probably was a slave early in her life. She's a great poet, and devotion and love was her path. And apparently she was an attractive, important lady. She had a lot of proposals, and she turned them all down because she basically said, I'm married to the divine. And Rabia is her name, and you can see she came about 100 years after Muhammad's death and very early in the tradition. And there's a lovely thing she says there at the bottom. O God, if I worship thee for fear of hell, then burn me in hell. If I worship thee in hope of paradise, exclude me from paradise. But if I worship thee for thy own sake, judge me, grudge me not thy everlasting beauty. In other words, no petitionary prayers. You know, we pray to God, oh, make me rich, cure me, what have you. She says, just the love, the absolute, the divine, and without any conditions. That was her path. Now, the most famous ecstatic Sufi is Mansur al-Halaj. He had an ecstatic experience, and he said, I am the truth, cost him his life. That's heresy if you interpret it the same way. Because I am the truth. Well, I'm the prophet. No, Muhammad's the seal of the prophet. He's the last prophet. But they misunderstood him. He was in jail 11 years, and one of the caliphs didn't like him at all. And the caliph approached Mansur's teacher, and who ordered the fatwa that ordered his execution. It's very tragic, because what Mansur Halaj was really saying is, I have experienced the divine, and that's our true nature. And it cost him his life. Okay. Now, one of the most important figures in Islam, whether it's traditional or Sufi, is the next person, Al-Ghazali. I don't know if anybody's heard of him before, but Al-Ghazali is, I would say, if you had to pick three or four people, the most important people in the Islamic tradition, his name would be a very strong contender. He was a brilliant person. I give you some information about his life, but I'm a little worried about the time. And the bottom line is, he was so brilliant and so good, by the time he was in his early 30s, he was teaching in Baghdad at the most prestigious university. The sultans and the caliphs loved him, and he wrote books on philosophy and everything, and he was at the top of his career. Big winner. Then, something happened. He went into what I perceive as a very serious emotional crisis, I think depression, because he, despite all his knowledge, he hadn't experienced the divine. And he dropped out for 10 years, became a Sufi, followed the path. One of his students that was with him is also one of the most important people in Islam, Rabi. I'll get to him next. And Ghazali had his ecstatic experiences, but he's a sober Sufi. He worked his way to it. And he's very important, because when he came back and started to teach again, he integrated the mystical way with traditional Islam in such a way it did not threaten the establishment. Okay? And that direct experience, etc., were okay, and I talked to you last week about the sources of Sharia, the four, and one of them, if you remember, was the development of the principles of law, of how to live your life through legal reasoning and what have you. And a couple hundred years before Al-Ghazali, they said, oh, we know everything, we'll close it, no more changes to Sharia. Al-Ghazali, with his teachings and his openness, opened that up again. It's called opening up the ittijab. That's the thing. So he was very important in opening it up so that the Sharia could continue to be changed as times changed over the centuries. He's a pivotal figure, and Okay, well, I'll stop there. Except for one thing. In the middle of page 5, Al-Ghazali, if one loves someone because it gives pleasure, one should not be regarded as loving that person at all. He's a hard guy. But the next one, though, is a really beautiful non-dual statement. The happiness of the drop, you and me, is to die in the river where we merge with the absolute. Okay, that's a metaphor. It's the only way you can talk about liberation and non-duality. Now, Ibn al-Arabi was the next great Sufi, and he was with al-Ghazali during that 10-year, the last part of that 10-year period. Al-Arabi is considered one of the greatest minds, intellectually speaking, and teachers of philosophy and Sufism in the history of the world. He's a giant, just like al-Ghazali. These two guys appeared on the scene. They're quite incredible. And he wrote over 350 books. He wrote on every subject. And I'm jumping ahead on page 6. At the top, there's a beautiful statement which is aligned with some of the quotes that I have from Rumi. The very top, page 6. Arabi says, "You are yourself the cloud veiling your own sun." In other words, your ego is blocking your gnosis of your true self. So recognize the essential reality of your being. In other words, we block ourselves. I'll just like to jump ahead to Rumi on page 7. You know Rumi, of course, the great poet as well as Sufi master. At the bottom, about 2 or 3 inches up, Rumi says, "I live on the lip. I live on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons. I'm knocking on a door. It opens. I've been knocking from the inside." That's the same as what Arabi's saying up here. Okay, my own self-delusion. I think it's beautiful. And I'm sure Arabi influenced Rumi. Arabi developed this concept of the unity of being. It's a beautiful metaphorical description of the non-dual absolute. And I have it, some comments there. And if you work on the spiritual path, what do you have to do to get there? Well, he said you have to become the perfected man or woman. And when you are perfected, you will have self-knowledge and experience the absolute. Okay. Can somebody tell me the time? I didn't bring my watch.
10:40.
Okay. I'm sorry I'm going fast. This is such a huge subject. Anybody have any questions about at this point? Okay. Am I right that most of you know about Rumi or heard about him, the great poet? Well, he was a great Sufi master, of course. And I live about half the or more in Turkey, and I've been able to take several trips to Konya, which is, you know, where Ankara is, the capital of Turkey, is kind of a dead center in the country. If you go due south, about 150 miles, there's a big city called Konya. And that's where Rumi spent most of his life. And that's where he's buried. And there's a special spiritual center there built around his mosque. And he's buried above ground next to his father and his son. And it was his son who succeeded him in running the show there who developed the Melvani tradition, and that is the whirling dervishes, which you're all familiar with. And the whirling dervishes, the dance is a form of meditation. You know, they wear the hat. The hat is the tombstone of the ego, and they take it off. And basic during the dance, one hand is pointed up, the other hand is pointed down, the divine, the secular. And the idea is to, by doing this whirling, you go into a meditational state, and it helps purify yourself and makes possible an experience of the other. Okay. Of course, I got to mention the fact that he also spent 3 years with his own, a teacher called Shams, and they were together for 3 years. And there's a lot of stories about that. Shams died after 3 years. They think somebody might have murdered him. They're not sure. That's quite a thing. I love Rumi. So wide open at the bottom of page 7. You might say he ran into people that said, oh, I can't keep my vows. I break them all the time and I fall off the wagon, blah, blah, blah. Here's what he says. Spiritual journey should be of joy. Come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving. Ours is no caravan of despair. Come, even if you've broken your vows 1,000 times, come yet again, come. You just feel this man's love and compassion. I just love that thing. At the top of page 8, I mention his great work, the Mathnavi. It's a collection of his poems and work. I think a few years ago, Rumi was the biggest selling poet in the United States. Okay. All right. I feel like I'm galloping. Modern Neo-Sufism. Non-Quran based. This is on page 8. Okay. I list... some of these groups have a non-existent connection with Islam. Others have very deeper roots. For example, the Golden Sufi Center, the third one there, is a tradition that evolved out of India. There were a lot of Sufis in India, by the way. And then you have others that are not. I'll speak briefly to them. I think it's very... Have you all heard of Hazrat Imad Khan? Yeah, he was a very important person. He had a very short life. About 46 or 7 years. He came to the United States and he preached a universal tolerance and love that's quite beautiful. You can Google his 10 principles. And he's considered the founder of what's called universal Sufism. And he was born in India and came to America. And he says, you can follow any path or religion you were born into. Because they all trying to get us to go home. Remember, religion, religare, back to our source. And whether you take the bus or the train or the airplane, we're all on that journey. And he was a man of great tolerance and acceptance and a preacher of love. And He basically started the Sufi movement in the West, basically. Now, important person, turn the clock back 50 years, how many here have ever heard of Sufi Sam? Anybody? I really date myself. Okay. Samuel Lewis, he was born in San Francisco, was a great Sufi master here in the Bay Area, and he was the guru Sufi teacher of the hippies and everything else, but that doesn't diminish him at all. He was a very advanced soul, and he was also, and he did wonderful teachings, a little biographical statement I have here. I just want to mention it. He was also a good friend of Joe Miller. Who's Joe Miller? Joe Miller was the president of the Theosophical Society in San Francisco, a practicing Sufi, a former vaudeville entertainer in his young age. And I was fortunate enough to have known Joe Miller a little bit, not real well. And in 1979, a yogi from India showed up at my house for a year. And during that time, he became friends with Joe Miller, and he came to the house, and they used to have satsang and gatherings together. And there's some information there about that. But these were two very beautiful people that contributed a lot to modern Sufism and being wide open. Anybody have any question at this point?
Hi. Can you say anything about, or if there is a connection between Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, and there was an author, and I forgot his name.
I'm sorry. Are you saying a little louder?
Jewish Kabbalah and Sufism, because there was a Jewish author in the 1600s, I believe, in Europe, maybe Spain, who wrote a lot of Kabbalah, and I don't know, did he hang out with Sufis at the time?
Yeah, I understand your question to be, what is the relationship between Kabbalistic mysticism and Sufi mysticism? Have I got that right? Okay, it's a hearing thing. I think they're first cousins, to give you that answer. I think the five levels of soul in Kabbalah, three in the body, the Nefesh and Ruach and Neshama are three levels of soul, and then two levels of soul in Kabbalah beyond the body, Chaya, the level of consciousness of Moses, revelation, and Yechida, the non-dual level of experience in Kabbalah, five levels of soul. And Yechida, don't overload you, you know, the Ein Sof emanated the tree of life, the cosmos. Yechida is at that point of transition. And the Sufis talk about revelation. They don't use the word chaya. They talk about merging and absorption. They don't use the word yachita, but it's the same thing. Okay, does that help? That's a big question. I only have two. I can't hear you. Okay. The question, who was the Jewish writer see, Kabbalah started in southern France. The teachers kept coming up, and as the time went by, you kept going down into Spain. And it was a series of important writers. I have them all listed in my chapter on Kabbalah. I'm sorry. It's time. I have to tease you a little bit. But I could open the book and read it and ask you if one of the names rings a bell. Could be one of several. It might be Abdullah Alpha, who taught meditation, but I'm not sure.
Alex, you do have about 5 minutes left.
Okay. Sufism reoriented. How many here have heard of Meher Baba? So, quite a few. Yeah, he was the gentleman from India. He took a vow of silence. He had mystical experiences. And he brought to America the teachings of Sufism, but he changed them a lot. And he's definitely not Quran based, because he declared himself, or his followers did, that he is an avatar, a prophet. That violates the principle that Muhammad is the seal of the prophet. So that put a big distance away from him. And he also thought that Zoroastrianism was an important root of Sufism, a very controversial position. And he has a place in I think South Carolina, and he's been to the States. And so I'll just let that go. Another important one, which I have had a little experience with, the Golden Sufi Center, founded by this woman, Arima Tweedy. She was quite a woman. She went to India, found a great Sufi teacher there, and stayed with him until he died. And then she wrote her experiences up in a book, and it was an international bestseller. And then she sold 100,000 or more copies. Then she wrote a sequel, another 40,000 copies. And she continued that lineage. Remember I said the lineage to prove the legitimacy of the Islamic masters? Well, there are 36 of them. I list the last couple there. And the 36th one, Llewellyn Vaughan Lee, he brought the main headquarters of that order to San Mateo County. And last June, I went to hear his annual lecture. He's an English guy who looks much younger than his 63 or 65 years, and I was quite impressed with his, they have a one-day program every June with what he had to say about humanity, climate change, and the environment. I was very impressed. And he has the center is also located as a group of his followers in Point Reyes, California. Okay? And then pushing on, Neo-Sufism, Indra Shah, you're probably familiar with him. He's written more books about Sufism than anybody else. One of them is about the very famous character, Nasiruddin. Question back there?
Three books.
I've got to have the mic. I can't hear you.
He's written three books on Mullah Nasiruddin.
Oh, three books. Oh, you're a devotee of Idris Shah. Okay. It's wonderful. And then over in Nevada, as the International Association of Sufism, they sponsor an annual international conference all the time, every year. And so that's right here. A lot of Sufism here in the Bay Area. And by the way, the one... I jumped ahead of myself. I've got to mention this. On Sufism Reoriented, there's a major center in Walnut Creek, and it's run by a woman who's in charge of it. And I had lunch with a friend of mine, a former 94-year-old colleague of mine from the college, Paul, who's incredible. And he said to me, did you know the Sufis out here are in the process of building some huge complex? So it must be this group there. So if you want to explore, you can go to those places. Yes.
I see a reference to Gurdjieff.
Right. Thank you. I was just going to get to it.
He has the Enneagram aspect, and I'm curious, has this Sufism and Enneagram been integrated in some way?
Yeah. Well, see, that's what's wonderful about the Sufi path. Whatever tools that appeal to you intellectually or to your heart, they're fine. Absolutely. See, at the bottom of page 10, I list three very important spiritual teachers who were either practicing Sufis or influenced by Sufism and contributed to them. And the last one, Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff, of course, had Sufism as some say he was trained by some Sufi masters. And he had a lot of respect for that, and also the practice of the Enneagram was important. You know, Claudio Narano and those people came up from Chile and instilled it here in the Bay Area. But to answer your question, beyond just the Enneagram, if you want to meditate, you meditate. If you want to do the Enneagram, you do that. If you want to do service for others, go in a Peace Corps or something like that, it's all fine. Anything that's raising your consciousness and cleaning out the egocentric side of our nature is just fine. There's no problem.
Well, Alex, that's probably a good note to stop on so people can get to the service at 11
o'clock. Okay, we're running late. Well, it was great to see you again. Maybe see you next
year. Thank you so much. It was really good.
Okay, bye-bye.